From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. 2017 was a grim year for the United States. Many modest gains made under Barack Obama's presidency were swiftly undone, and Donald Trump's radical agenda to remake the government became reality faster than we expected. With the passage of a sweeping tax bill at the end of the year, what will year two of the Trump presidency bring? And much more importantly, what sort of activism will be most effective against it? We'll spend the hour today with our regular correspondent, Arun Gupta, who joined me recently in studio to discuss Trumpism and its impact, progressive activism, and more. Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, Raw Story, and The Intercept. He's also author of the forthcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's a regular news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali.
Thanks for having me on today, Sonali.
So you being here in Los Angeles, where our program is produced, gives us a great opportunity to sit down for a whole hour today and reflect on what has been a very, very grim past 12 months. It's very easy to slip into a mass collective depression, but we, of course, can't allow ourselves to do that. And so what I wanted to do today was begin with a sense, a perspective of what has been lost over the past year, which is essentially equivalent to what Trump and his party have achieved. Their victories have been our losses. And the tax bill is the most recent GOP victory slash progressive loss or loss to the American people. But there have been lots of other things that have happened sort of behind the scenes or out of our radar that we haven't even paid attention to. How would you summarize what has been lost in 2017?
I think for a lot of people, what's been lost is hope. And that's kind of the most tragic thing. But, you know, it definitely has been a pretty dark and grim year. I don't like saying dark. It makes it sound negative. I don't think dark's a bad thing. It's obviously a lot of really messed up things have happened regarding immigration, the Muslim ban, climate change, refugees, healthcare. The federal bureaucracy is being shredded to bits. You know, we're just seeing all these attacks on the remnants of the social welfare state, and a lot of the worst is yet to come. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people don't pay attention to stuff going on with organized labor, and that's mainly because it has to do with technical details. But recently, we saw a rule change, and it's one of these technical NLRB rule changes that allowed that what it said is that employers have a joint responsibility for franchisees. And what this meant is that workers at McDonald's could force McDonald's to come to the table instead of thousands of franchisees. This was a big victory that had been won during the Obama year, and it was just recently overturned. And we're going to see this terrible, absolutely terrible decision coming down next year that's essentially going to bring right to work. It's the case.
And by next year, you mean this year now?
Right. Exactly. You know, I keep hoping it's next year. The decision, which is referred to as Janus, is expected to come down in June, in which the Supreme Court is basically going to say public sector is now right to work also. And so this is a direct attack on organized labor and also on the progressive forces and the Democratic Party. I mean, and this is, I think, you know, people should have realized this when Trump was on the election trail. And, you know, you had me on and we were trying to sound the warning bells repeatedly that this is something extraordinarily dangerous. But I think a lot of the left is just so sclerotic and fossilized that it really couldn't look beyond its dogmas. to see the phenomenal danger. It was just so knee-jerk anti-Clinton, anti-Democratic Party. That's like, yeah, they're part of the ruling class. They've done plenty of terrible things. But you have a white nationalist authoritarian who is... Who was promoting white supremacists and neo-Nazis during the campaign trail, who's talking about deporting millions, who's talking about Muslim bans, who's talking about unleashing the police and law and order and on and on and on. None of this comes as a surprise. And we actually, you know, a few days ago, we were talking about this, and I was like, there's only been one thing really that's surprising about Trump, and that's when he threatened to invade Mexico. That was like, oh, okay, I didn't expect that one. But nothing he's done has surprised me, because I covered this Joker for a year, and I saw this movement come into being. So... you know, the damage is significant, but at the same time, we have to have hope, and we have to realize that this is a long game, and that, you know, humanity has gone through many dark periods, and it's important to get back to basics. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've really learned during the last year for myself is to get off social media. Social media is really just an awful place. And you, again,
as we live stream on Facebook.
Well, yeah. But I mean, you know, we don't need to look any further than Trump. He weaponized Twitter to come to power. This is not some sort of liberatory democratic medium. It's perfect for demagogues. And it's also, you know, when you're on social media all the time, you're just making money for companies like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and all those.
Do you feel like social media kind of fosters that helplessness while making you feel like you're doing something simply because you're reading and interacting with people in a virtual space?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, definitely for some people, you know, it's understandable. They may be really busy, or they may have disabilities or other problems. And that's fine, you know, to use it as a tool, but don't make it your primary source of organizing or activism. And you know, one thing I wanted to say that I hope people really take to heart, you know, if you're not doing this already, resolve in 2018 to go to at least one political meeting or event a week. You know, organizing is done face to face. We want to build a human society. And the only way you can do it is actually going out, talking to people and interacting with them. And if you are going to these meetings, and you know, we'll talk about this more. I've talked to plenty of people who are now dealing with burnout. Make it fun. You know, it's important to find joy wherever you can. Like, just having, for me, a lot of it revolves around food, like making dinner with friends, having dinner with friends. You know, we live, for better or for worse, in a very food-centric culture. So I think, you know, just have feasts, just have festivities with people who you do political work with or who are like-minded. And when I am often interviewing organizers about, like, how they actually go out and get people. And, you know, let's also make a distinction, because this is going to be very important in 2018, between organizing and mobilizing. Elections are about mobilizing, right? They are, and same with protests. They're about bringing out the already committed. Organizing is about changing people's minds, right? And about bringing the new into movements. You know, that's what Occupy Wall Street, that's what the Tea Party did. That's what Obama did in 2008. That's what Trump did in 2016. And, you know, we saw some of that earlier this year with the protests against the Muslim bans, but especially the women's marches, right? You know, where you're bringing all these new people. I was in D.C., and I've been to so many different demonstrations in D.C., and it was just extraordinary. There were so many people at the women's march the day after inauguration in Washington, D.C., that we couldn't even march.
Yeah, we had the same experience in Los Angeles, which, by the way, outnumbered D.C. in the total number of attendees. I was very proud of that. But you're right, you couldn't even move.
Yeah, and same in New York. And this, and you know, and I get on social media and I see all these leftists on it. You know, it's just like, oh, this is just a bunch of liberals. It's just like, well, where is this like mass communist revolutionary left ready to storm, you know, the Winter Palace and overthrow the reactionary forces? Face it, the left is incredibly isolated. And I think the left is isolated because it isolates itself. And I count myself on the left, right? You know, so, but I think get out and actually talk to people and learn how how to listen. I mean, I think that's really the most important thing. As a reporter who goes across the country, I had to learn how to do this, where people will say really offensive stuff to you, but that's the point. You know, I liken it to you're trying to, like, draw a poison from a body. No, seriously, you don't do it by pushing it in, by condemning them. You have to get them to reveal their real feelings and to try and find a point of connection. Now, there are plenty of people you can't find a point of connection with. And, you know, I'm not opposed to Nazis getting punched in the face or, you know, even worse. Not that I'm going to do it. But the point is, we need to figure out how to change people's opinion, how to actually organize them. And that means meeting them face to face and not spending all your time venting about how terrible the Democrats are on social media.
Which we agree they're terrible, and we cover that on our program quite a bit. I've talked about that with you, but let's also take stock of you did a quick rundown of what was lost in 2017. But one of the things that seemed off of the mainstream media's radar were the major movements that emerged in 2016. Some of the amazing victories, or you know, I should say battles that were won, even if wars were lost later. Among them, Black Lives Matter, the Standing Rock protests, low wage work. Yeah. So in 2017, did those movements disappear, or were they simply not being covered? I mean, let's start with Black Lives Matter, which was, I wrote a column on Truth Dig at the end of 2016, felt that Black Lives Matter was hands down the movement of the year.
No, I agree with that. And I think part of it is that the media is not covering it as much. Part of it is now what we see is a lot of reactive protest. You know, it started with the Women's March and, you know, those spontaneous protests against the Muslim ban. There was a scientist march. There was the climate justice march in April. And a lot of, you know, but again, this was clear with Trump's strategy, that he was just going to throw so much stuff at the fan, because that's the way his campaign worked, that it's to exhaust people, that you just can't keep up with it. So Black Lives Matter has by no means gone away. And, you know, I think it's best to think of it as like as a constellation of forces. It is kind of this loose movement, and I think it is
by design.
And that's a good thing. You know, you'll see when you have a real movement, you'll see all sorts of different sections of the movement with different ideas pursuing different strategies. You know, and that's what you want, and that means that you have density, that you have a lot of creativity there. But you know what's going on now? Black Lives Matter hasn't gone away, but a lot of this energy is going into electoral politics. And this is something, you know, that we're going to keep coming back to. And this is one of the unfortunate realities of the era of Trump that we now live in, and that you're just not going to be able to fight. No, it doesn't matter if you think like electoral politics are a waste of time. And we know Democrats are part of the ruling class, but you're not going to convince anyone that somehow Hillary Clinton was going to be worse than this abomination in the White House.
So for Black Lives Matter to be pouring their energy into electoral politics, that's a broad statement. What sort of electoral politics, right? Because when there have been movements at the local level, and it has happened, that have, for example, changed the district attorney, that has a very real impact on people's lives. And so local electoral politics doesn't have to be a death knell for social movements, right?
It doesn't have to be a death knell, but it does have its limits. I mean, some of the victories that we saw as a result of Black Lives Matter, you know, it first began with the killing of Trayvon Martin, but it really jumped a level after Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson in 2014. We saw, you know, there were some halting moves to deny military surplus equipment to local police forces. We saw that there were also moves to basically the program where police departments are allowed to keep money. You know, it's essentially now police departments are stealing more money from citizens than burglaries across the country. And this has all been reversed by the Trump administration. We saw under Obama and Holder all these numerous consent decrees with big city police departments, you know, in terms of like actually monitoring them because of violence against poor people, against people of color, against homeless people, against mentally ill people. I know Seattle, Chicago, Portland, those were just some of the cities where, and this has all been reversed. And so I think, you know, a lot of the activism, people see a certain level of futility. And then we also see all these attacks on activism in many states. Legislatures are increasing the criminalization of nonviolent direct action.
And so the very act of protest, because they know how effective it can be.
Right, right. So it's raising the costs and the risks. And, you know, you can't, like, tell people, like, oh, go protest if you're going to land in jail for years. So I think a lot of this is being forced into electoral politics. And by that, we mean, like, kind of at the municipal and state level. So we're seeing various races, like for mayor, for city legislatures, for like state senates, you know, even in the South where you have Black Lives Matter organizations that are pouring energy doing getting out the vote for candidates who are sympathetic to their ideas. And it's a positive thing, but it's not going to, I think, have the impact the way that people who were, when Black Lives Matter was in the streets, shutting things down, right? It was actually disrupting power. It was disrupting the normal course of business. That's what you need to do to have an effect.
And they may be doing that and may not be getting the attention that they were getting before because everything seems to have shifted. The Standing Rock protests were a huge highlight of 2016 as well. And with a sheer stroke of his pen, Trump undid the work that so many activists did is basically bringing back Keystone. And so in the sort of pipeline politics aspect, as they intersect, especially with Native American activism, which has been at the forefront now of our new wave of environmental movements, where do you see that having gone in 2017?
You know, I think the climate justice activism, it's one of the movements. I mean, I think there is some good stuff going on with organized labor and immigrant rights, what we're talking about. With climate justice activism, I think people are going more to the local level. So you're seeing a lot of stuff on the West Coast in terms of trying to put up barriers, regulatory and legal barriers to the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure. And the reason this matters is the West Coast is the gateway for all this energy in the interior, right? You know, so you know, over Christmas, the Trump administration, it loosened rules for fracking, it loosened rules for offshore oil exploration. They're gutting this Office of Chemical Safety.
EPA.
They're gutting OSHA, Occupational Safety Health Administration. They've, you know, the stream buffer rule for coal mining, on and on and on. They're opening up ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife. It's horrifying, you know, and but a lot of this is meant for export to Asia, which is energy hungry. And the only way they can do it is through a very limited number of ports on the West Coast. There are not many access points. And so climate justice activists have had a lot of success in terms of stopping a lot of these infrastructure projects. A lot of it is complicated because it also has to do with the economics of it. But what they're doing is by raising the cost, they're making it uneconomical. But things like, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline, the DAPL pipeline, sure, there were other pipelines that were being approved by the Obama administration, but these were tangible victories, and they were really important victories because they're bringing people into the movement. And we know also with DAPL, you know, the Standing Rock, just the horrifying level of state repression, of infiltration, people being railroaded on bogus charges, looking at decades in prison. So again, we shouldn't have any illusion about anyone who is in control of the state. It's a really repressive institution, but we need to recognize victories. And we had victories during the Obama years that were then just overturned with the stroke of a pen during the Trump years. Yeah.
The Dreamers were able to push Obama quite significantly in at least winning the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals programs. Obama tried to put the DAPA program, the next one, in place, but has been stymied. And just this past Christmas, the many young immigrants tried to confront the Democrats to hold the spending bill hostage to some deal on a DREAM Act. And the Democrats basically caved and said that they would agree to the one-month extension for the Republicans. Maybe that fight will play out in January this month. We don't know. But it doesn't seem as if the Democrats will hold to their promise to the Dreamers. So is that... I mean, on the one hand, we want we want to see grassroots pressure on Democrats and Republicans. That is effective. On the other hand, we know time and time again that the Democrats will not, are very, very hard to push. How do you assess what has happened to the Dreamers and the movement for undocumented immigrants in 2017, given that some of the strongest impacts of the Trump administration was on that community in the form of detentions, rounding up, and deportations?
Yeah. Now, I think, first of all, it's important to so that we understand the lay of the land. So when Obama comes in, he continues the repressive policies from the Bush era in terms of the detentions and removals. Deportations, there is actually no category under federal law known as deportations. That just becomes a shorthand. There's removals, there's exclusions, there's voluntary repatriations. And so what Obama did that was really just terrible and reprehensible was they were focused on a lot of interior removals. Again, that really starts during the last couple of years of the George W. Bush administration and continues under Obama. But by 2015, we see it drop by about 75%, right? So, yeah, there were still a significant amount of interior removals happening every year, but it was a huge drop from where it was in over the past decade. And again, that was a victory that I think many on the left failed to recognize as a victory. So recently it was announced like, oh, deportations have dropped under Trump. And again, there is no such category as deportations. What's going on is there's far fewer people who are trying to come over the border because of his extremist rhetoric. And so those there's a lot less what are called exclusions happening. In the interior, what we're seeing is a significant increase of removals starting to go up, and we're seeing what's called collateral removals. Now what we're looking at, because they refuse to play chicken with Trump and shut down the government over this, is there may be some sort of deal, but it's going to be who gets thrown under the bus to save the Dreamers. Right. You know, there's what may very well happen is they grant more enforcement powers, more discretion to ICE agents to operate more freely. They're going to be demanding more money for more agents and technology and maybe database programs to ferret out undocumented immigrants, you know, pushing them deeper in the shadows where they actually become victims to more crime and wage theft and things like that, domestic violence. And also Trump may try and push through money for the border wall. So it's not a good position. I think, you know, the one glimmer of hope has been the Dreamers who have been mounting these protests. Mm-hmm. But what we really need to see is a full court press. And I think one of the interesting examples is if we look at Arizona, you know, its activists there are, you know, after Trump was elected, the immigrant rights activists were saying, you know, well, now the rest of America is like Arizona. And the activists there have been fighting under these really draconian laws, and they have had some successes. They've stopped hundreds of deportations, but a part of it is a big part of it is, again, going back to the basics. They organize neighborhood defense groups where they're actually going out into neighborhoods, meeting with people. They'll have parties introducing people to each other, you know, building watch committees so they can track ICE. They can track how the police work. So they know they have their own intelligence, and they can help people avoid ICE agents. They can mount protests, big protests to try and force ICE to back down. But that's the kind of the situation we're in, almost as quasi like underground railroad in terms of immigration, where people need to be hidden and protected. But how do you protect, you know, 11 million undocumented immigrants?
So if it seems as though when we look back on the last couple of years and try to take stock of how to approach Trumpism. And I say Trumpism and not Trump because, of course, it's not just Trump himself. It's Trump, his party, the ideology. How to take it on in 2018, what's required of us is a lot. What is required of Americans, and not just progressives, but Americans, is tremendous. And it feels as though, just from hearing you reflect on the past year, we need multi-pronged, multi-issue solutions. And that requires every single one of us incorporating civic action into our daily lives. It's too easy to say, I'm going to vote, or I'm going to go to the Women's March, and then I'm going to rant on Facebook. Because that, unfortunately, gave us, you know, is what many of us had been doing, and we got Trump. And so beyond that, what you were saying in terms of having in as part of your day-to-day life, committing to go to one meeting a week, one sort of activity, just like you would do to foster a healthy life, to foster a healthy country, we are all of us, you know, I think going to be required to plug in many different ways all at once. And whether that's local politics, electoral politics, or actual mobilizing and organizing, whatever issue moves you, it's going to have to happen. Are we up to the task, or are we too demoralized?
Well, you know, I think we have to be up to the task. And I historically, we've seen many dark days in this country, you know, the depths of slavery, in terms of the Jim Crow era, the Klan terror.
And the lead up to Nazi Germany holds some lessons to for us too, right? I mean, this isn't too hyperbolic.
Yeah, it didn't work out so well for the left as a problem. But, you know, in terms of who was the anti-Nazi resistance in all those occupied countries, it was the left. And you did see very much a resurgent communist, radical, socialist left after World War II. But I think you're absolutely right. Everyone has to think of themselves as an organizer. But it's also important to just not constantly pile work on yourself, feel like you have to right every wrong that's going on in the world, because there's so many, it's hard to keep track. I mean, like, this to me is actually one of the defining moment of the Trump era is Hurricane Maria. Okay, so that devastated Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is Trump's Katrina, except it was a slow motion Katrina, right? We've seen like New York Times, CNN, ProPublica, they've all been going down there, Washington Post, doing these investigative reports showing like, yeah, initially there were about 50 or 60 deaths. Hurricane Katrina, I think it's like 1,700 deaths. But then over the next couple months, and the reports lag, you know, so, you know, you will start to see new reports come out later in January. But within the first 6 weeks, the number of excess deaths was already over 1,000 because the whole island was devastated, the healthcare system, nursing homes, obviously, hospitals, electricity, clean water. I mean, clean water is the essence of life itself. So over 1,000 people have died. And the thing is, so it took George W. Bush 5 years to have Hurricane Katrina that brought down his presidency. It took Donald Trump only 8 months to have his Hurricane Katrina. But this time, people really aren't paying attention because it is just this constant flow of just from the cesspool against the fan, and no one can keep up with it all.
So one of the bright spots last year in terms of activism, which, you know, it's sort of arguable how related directly that has been to the Trump administration and Trumpism, has been the hashtag MeToo movement. I mean, this is interesting because the revelations of Harvey Weinstein's assaults and rapes exploded into the national consciousness. This was a liberal, pro-democratic, I mean, to the point where he was literally funding the Democratic Party, a liberal, high-profile figure. And, you know, some people have felt that the hashtag MeToo movement has actually taken down too many progressives and Democrats, and maybe it's this big right-wing conspiracy. But, of course, what has happened is that women have sort of snapped, right? Women across the country have sort of felt that they've reached this moment where they're being heard. And there's been a sea change. How do you put the hashtag MeToo movement into the context of the Trump administration and whether it was the brightest spot of the past year?
Well, I think it has been, obviously behind the Me Too movement is a lot of horrifying stuff that's gone on, but you have to be aware of it and you have to understand it. I know some women who I tried to break into progressive media and were essentially preyed upon repeatedly by powerful men in left media and publishing, and their careers were derailed time and again. Because they were just, sexually harassed continuously, and they were eventually forced out. And so this is, I think, one of the real tragedies is that we see how much that we don't know how much that we've lost, right? This is what it started to come out with Hollywood. It wasn't just, these incredibly high profile, powerful women who were speaking out against the abuse, Ashley Judd and Rose McGowan and all of them, but it was all the women who wanted to get into Hollywood and who were tormented by these serial abusers, by these violent, depraved men, and their careers were destroyed or they never got off the ground. So I think Me Too has really highlighted, been able to highlight what we've lost. And I think for a lot of women, what I've seen is it's also given them the courage because they feel solidarity for the first time. That's, we saw this with Roy Moore in Alabama, that when these women were coming forward, they started just to be viciously attacked, and it's just people at the you find a lot of these people who are sexist, both mainly men but also women as well. Well, why didn't they come forward? Mm-hmm. If they should have come forward, and then it's who believes them? They're sluts, they're liars, they're being paid to say this. Well, this is why they didn't come forward, because of reactions.
If many women did come forward, they were ignored.
As with Trump, what was it? A dozen women came forward, and he's they're all liars. So I think in some ways it was also a delayed, I forget what the psychological, it was a displacement, with Harvey Weinstein, that they weren't able to take on Trump, but now it appears that roundabout they're able to get at him, because now there's revived talk of lawsuits going forward, of trying to hold him accountable. You had a number of women, female senators in particular, saying that Trump should resign. And I think, of course, politicians are politicians. Women like Kristen Gillibrand, she's she has this kind of like center right history, and I think she's opportunistically positioning herself for 2020. Nonetheless, you know, what is behind it is very real. Hopefully it will lead to a sea change in terms of how we as a society listen to women, and in terms of women's status and power in society. I mean, you know, we don't want like the lean in feminism, or what I call drone feminism of Hillary Clinton, right. You know, just if you paint the drones pink, that doesn't make it feminist.
Right. Well, to me, I know it's cliche, but it is true, is that a small group of people really can have a profound effect, can change the world, or at least they're part of the world. And, you know, in trying to find these kind of like glimmers of hope, the Richmond Progressive Alliance, you know, what they've been able to accomplish in Richmond, or the Malcolm X grassroots movement in Jackson, Mississippi. Again, you know, it's electoral politics. But it all started with a small group of people. I think, you know, Richmond Progressive Alliance, it started with like four people in the room.
Right.
But, you know, they just kept at it. And, you know, talking to one of the founding fathers, Roberto Reyes, he was just like, you know, often it's just about being the last person standing, that you just have to keep plugging away. And so I think that is the most important thing. I mean, you know, I would spend hours on Facebook and Twitter and all of that a day, Instagram, and I've cut my time down on it. It's like, yeah, it's more effort to get up off the couch and actually go to meetings and meet with people, and it can be frustrating, but it's a lot more rewarding, and you're actually building something other than your own frustration and sense of isolation.
Yeah. So in terms of making the year 2018 not be all about helping the Democrats retake the both houses of Congress, how do we balance that act? Because you and I have talked about this before. The Democrats are the enemy we want to fight. We don't want to be fighting the Republicans because, you know, it's a matter of life and death, where there are many more gains to be made under Democrats. So we want the Democrats to take back power, you know, find a way to do it. But we don't want all social movements to die in the process of electing them. So where does that balance come in? And I think this is where we need to have a discussion on the left that isn't happening often enough, about the dynamic between political party and social movement, the relationship between political party and social movement, because political parties and politicians want you to back them. And the Democrats are very excited about Trumpism delivering political power to them. So they have, you know, called upon movements time and time again to back them. But really, we need to be pushing them. We need to have the Democrats backing us. We need to have politicians backing us to change that dynamic so that we can see clearly that progressive politicians will be elected into power with our support if they do our bidding, as opposed to us lining up behind them and then going to sleep for four more years, right?
Yeah. You know, what we're seeing is extreme upper class warfare, right? But that does not naturally bring into being, you know, this working class consciousness. Class consciousness is a conscious project. It has to be nurtured and carefully built. And I think, you know, there is a glimmer that finally unions, of course, they should have realized this 40 years ago, back in the late 70s, when the real concerted assaults began on them. You know, now it's a life or death thing, where they're actually funding the stewards, they're building workplace units, they're identifying, you know, where they're active or not, they're trying to get all members on board, because once the right to work comes in, that means people can opt out, they don't have to pay dues,
right.
They become free riders,
right.
They get all the benefits,
and then unions become defunded, yeah.
Right, and the Republicans want to defund them is because the unions have allowed themselves to become an ATM for the Democratic Party. They poured a couple billions of dollars into the Democratic Party between 2006 and 2016. And I was out there arguing every election cycle, they should be putting at least half this money into actual
social organizing. Yeah, yeah. You know, they missed a huge opportunity after the Great Recession. They should have created like unions of the unemployed. And of course, you know, why didn't they do that? Then the answer to the question is simple, because the unemployed don't pay dues.
Yeah. Well, and here they're going to lose their dues now after all of this. And the Democratic Party's been able to take advantage of and take for granted the union leadership, to the point where you had some unions throwing their support behind, say, Hillary Clinton, before the primaries were even done, not even waiting in order to sort of see the candidates try to curry favor with them. Just here you have our support, and it is definitely detrimental to them. So yeah. Arun, we've talked a lot about the sort of what we lost, how we might try to take this multi-pronged approach to taking to staving off the worst losses, taking on Trumpism in 2018, but doing all of that without burning out, without, you know, and this is a very real problem on the left. Burnout is a real problem on the left, partly because too few people take on the struggle, and then they take it on full time or more than full time, and then they burn out and then they disappear. And when we want a broader swath of Americans to take activism up as part of their daily lives, to do it in a way that is healthy and in a way that doesn't destroy themselves, is critical. So let's talk about food, which is what you and I both love a lot, and which is what we were trying to find a good segue into from politics. Organizing while breaking bread is critical, isn't it?
I know, and you know, listeners don't know, but Sonali made me a delicious Maharashtrian dinner Friday night. So that was quite a treat. I think, you know, a 100 years ago, if kind of leftists were to get together, they might be, doing it over singing or theater or some sort of cultural activity.
You have to throw that Emma Goldman quote in there. Come on.
Yeah. If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of that has been commodified. Like people, everyone doesn't know how to sing and play an instrument anymore. So now what we tend to do is we share culture through food. And I think that's a perfectly fine way to do it. But I think it is really important that when we get together, I've spent so much of my life in meetings. And what I've noticed is if you do it around breaking bread, especially if someone is a really good cook and cooks for everyone, it really changes the nature and the tenor of the meeting, because you're sharing basically, you know, it's not just the food, you're sharing kind of their affection, their creativity, mm-hmm. And you can have these hard discussions, but it creates a much warmer, more personable atmosphere. And I think that's what we often forget on the left, that we have this very kind of austere and Spartan culture. And in fact, you know, it's just like I've probably said this before on the show, you know, like one of my critiques of the American left is it's more American than left, in that it's individualistic, it's anti-intellectual, it's consumeristic, and most of all, it's puritanical. It denies pleasures of the body, you know, that it wants to like constantly judge. You know, if you don't want to eat meat, great, you know, but don't start judging other people. You know, if they want to, you're not saving the world because you're eating tofu. Those grains probably came 10,000 miles away and involved a trail of environmental destruction, all those fake meat products. So the point is, don't judge each other. Find ways to like share community, build community in where you like each other's companies, where it's not just about all these difficult political debates. And for me, and I think for a lot of people, it's through food. And, you know, again, when I like talk to organizers, it's just like, so how do you do it? How do you get, it's just like, well, we have a pizza party or we held a barbecue. Mm-hmm. Like when I was covering the Occupy Our Homes movement, I was like, okay, so how do you, when you're trying to defend someone's home, how do you reach out to neighbors? And there'd be like, we would just first have a block party. And I heard that in city after city. And they were often just hitting on the same idea individually, you know, whether it was in Oakland or Atlanta or Minnesota, Minneapolis, you know, they're like, okay, how do we get people out here? Well, you kind of just bribe them, you know?
I mean, I discovered this as an undergraduate in college, the best way to get students to show up for anything was to offer free food. Of course, it was crap food. And you and you and I would like to set a higher standard for the quality of food. And I want to let our audience know that Arun is going to be spending the 2018 working on his forthcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. Right. So, which is very exciting. You're going to spend a lot of time and have already spent a lot of time thinking about food in various ways. And you know, I think you're right. We sort of get too Spartan and are too puritanical about the way in which we consume food. I have not hung out with some friends for years because I stopped being vegetarian and they became a little bit more hardcore vegan. And we found we just didn't find that common space anymore to hang out, even though we share so many other things in common. And so it's okay to have a tofu dish alongside this London broil. Yeah. but also this brings me to the other question, which is when one bribes one's friend or loved one to come to the table and eat, can one talk politics without hating on each other? Because many of us have found that we have Trump supporters among our members of our family. We also, of course, have people who voted for Hillary Clinton and love the Democrats and think that all we need to do is put Democrats back into power because things were so fantastic under Obama and that's all we need. And it's hard to have those really hard conversations over dinner because as Americans, we've been trained to not talk religion or politics at the dinner table, which is terrible because we should talk about both at the dinner table.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think this is certainly something that has been obviously, it's really disconcerting. I don't want to call it it's not a civil war, but there's definitely a lot of strife in this country that is very granular. It's being reproduced at millions of dinner tables over the holidays. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say I have the best strategy, you know, but and I haven't confronted some. I have a very large family, so I'm not going to out anyone. I'm not going to name names. Lots and lots of relatives in the U.S. And, you know, I have one Anglo relative who married into my Indian family through some cousins who he voted for Trump and is half Indian for Donald Trump. I was just talking to a friend who she's an immigrant from Korea, and her Korean parents voted for Trump.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, I think a lot of it is people, like she just explained it as well, they vote for Trump because they just don't know, and everyone else around them was voting for Trump. Whereas, you know, cousins-in-law that I'm talking about, I think they have reactionary political attitudes, but they're also just not necessarily that bright. But you know, I mean, you know, what I wanted to say is like, look, you know, you are voting for the people who were in the racist mobs outside of our home when we were young. You're voting for the people who want to disappear us. And by disappear, we mean deport or kill.
Yeah. And how to share dinner with, let alone fellow activists. We talked about, you know, trying to find common ground with our vegan friends. But what about the people who voted for the person who would like to disappear us all, who voted for the ideology that wants people of color to disappear? That's really hard to face. And I have a member of my family that I do not know how to confront anymore. I do not know how to look at him in the face anymore, because in my mind, I think you have essentially chosen to politically cast your lot with somebody who would rather not have me and my brown children around.
Yeah. And I think, you know, maybe they need to be confronted with that. And you know, it's just like, you know, it's just
over
like
really good bread.
You know, it's just like, I love you, but you need to, like, confront this in yourself.
Yeah.
you know, that you voted for people who want to kill and deport us. You know, and you need to come to grips with that. And, you know, and I think, you know, one of the good lines I heard about Trump, I don't think it's entirely true, but it is a good way to make people think who voted for him, because it gives them a little out. You know, not everyone who voted for Trump is a racist, but the racism wasn't a deal breaker.
Right. Exactly. So, Arun, I want to sort of segue into another. We didn't talk about this beforehand, but it just sort of occurred to me. You know, food is the way in which our cuisines develop are a reflection of our immigrant heritage. Almost every country you go to, food is the product of cultures that have come in over time and foods that have been easily available because of geography. I know this is probably even getting into some of the territory that your book is exploring. I watch a lot of cooking shows, and there's a British TV show, The Great British Bake Off, which has a lot of immigrant amateur cooks that know how to make, like, you know, what is it, Yorkshire bread, Yorkshire pudding.
Yeah.
Because when they come in as immigrants, they naturally adapt to the culture that they're part of and share their culture with the country that they are from as well. Can our food, you know, we know Donald Trump will eat tacos. We know that Trump voters enjoy, you know.
Well, no, he'll eat taco bowls.
Taco bowls, exactly, yeah. But can food be a demonstration of the fact that we are part of a shared people, that you don't have a bright line between whites and non-whites as much as you'd like there to be?
Well, you know, maybe the next time I have the Trump voting relatives over. So I'm also a French trained chef. Mm-hmm. And so not only do I like to cook, I'm pretty decent at it. Mm-hmm. I cooked professionally for a couple years in New York City. And I whenever I go home for the holidays, I am given, but I also take on the responsibility for either cooking Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas dinner. And when it comes to the Thanksgiving dinner, I've become very much a traditionalist.
Me too. Oh my goodness. Look at this. Two immigrants who like to cook. I mean, okay. Yeah, Except I draw the line at marshmallows on sweet potatoes.
Well, I don't do that, you know, or the, you know, the green bean casserole with the, Campbell's cream of mushroom soup and the turkey fried onion rings on top. I do have a little bit of a soft spot for that, but I don't make it. But what I'm doing is just really, like, I'm getting the best turkey possible, mm-hmm. and I'm making my stuffing from scratch. You know, I make the cornbread for the stuffing, the stock, and all that. You know, of course, I'm making the gravy from the drippings and the cranberry sauce. It's not good. It's not
from fresh cranberries.
Yeah, it's not this quivering you know, cylinder that comes out of the can. I mean, you know, that to me, it's just like there's something very comforting about it, that it's something that I can return to and that I can also keep trying to improve on. I'm trying to do the same thing year after year, but I can improve on it. But, you know, maybe what I should do is, you know, maybe make a real traditional Thanksgiving dinner. I've been doing a lot of research into, you know, what Americans have eaten, and, like, you know, going back, you know, every decades for 200 years, and how foods have changed. And you go back, like, even in the late 1800s, early, you know, late 19th, early 20th century, I mean, the American diet was so incredibly limited. Mm-hmm. Like, especially in the South, basically, a lot of people were just surviving on a corn pone, which was just like a cornmeal that was fried in lard, which is pig fat, and then maybe with some pieces of, like, bacon. And if you're lucky, maybe there were some, and for like three meals a day. Oh. And maybe this is what I should make for the Thanksgiving dinner. It's just like, here, you don't like immigrants, here's what your meal is. Oh. You know, you get a giant vat of corn pone, because this is, we're making America great again, starting with your Thanksgiving dinner. Okay. I mean, it's just like, you enjoy enjoy everything that you immigrants bring to this country. You know, it's just like, you know, the food, the culture. We're doing everything from, you know, mowing your lawns and taking care of your dying parents to building your computers and healing you in the hospital. Mm-hmm. You know, you enjoy it. And yet you want to, like, kick us all out, mm-hmm. you know. And I think, you know, maybe just making them confronted. I don't know if people have any other strategies, mm-hmm. like, you know, if you do, like, you know, put them in the comments, like, how do you talk to those Trump
right, we don't have the answers.
Yeah, yeah.
You've been watching and listening to our one-hour special on confronting Trumpism with Arun Gupta. He's an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, Raw Story, and The Intercept. And he's the author of the forthcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's also a regular news correspondent for our show. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.